Hey, welcome to the Friday podcast. We got a great one for you. We start with how to win the hearts and minds of people. If we are going to beat socialism, we have to be better storytellers. And I take a case of Ocasio-Cortez and something, a story that you probably heard in two lines from your friends, and you joked about it, but you missed the real story and how to make that point. And we'll give that to you right at the top of the podcast. Bill O'Reilly's here. Where is AOC getting her money? Her fairy godfather here in Texas, Will Witt, joins us. The future of conservatism and the three things that he says are essential to build the left.
And also, I would encourage you, if you happen to be a subscriber to this podcast, you're going to see one pop up on this weekend from Bob Goff. It's an interview with Glenn and Bob Goff. This guy is an amazing guy. He's kind of like a superhero because he's like the most positive person I've ever met in my entire life. But he has a perspective on life that all of us should gain. It's hard to do, I think, as well as he does it. But that's a really inspiring and a really good interview to put life in perspective.
Yeah,
and it's going to be on this feed this weekend, so look for it.
And it really kind of fits into how to win friends, influence people, how to change the country. He's remarkable, Bob Goff. On this podcast, it'll come out on Saturday, along with the other 25 interviews that we've done. Just binge on those if you haven't listened to them. All right, let's get right to it. Friday's podcast.
You're listening to the best of the Glenn Beck program.
So yesterday, Stu and I had quite a conversation. It kind of lasted almost the whole show. Going back and forth in total agreement, but we couldn't let it go. We're in agreement, but Stu finds it really irritating that we have to do this. And I suppose he's right, but it is part of human nature. Mm-hmm. And that is, people need the story. You need to connect to the heart. And conservatives suck at the story. And yesterday I was telling you, you know, all the liberals will be on stage putting a show together and all of the conservatives will be running the theater. And that's the way I actually want it, because, you know, I want people who are really focused on the facts and the numbers running the theater. I don't want those bean counters. I don't want a show done by accountants. You know what I mean? I don't. And I don't want to work in a theater where the accounting job are done by a bunch of actors.
Even The Office, which was a show about accountants, had to be done by liberals.
Yeah, I mean, so it's just the way the world is. So if we want to talk to people, the best way to talk to people is through stories. And we suck at telling stories. And even when they are handed to us, we screw it up. Even when they're handed to us, what happens? We don't tell the story, and we miss the opportunity because we speak our language only to ourselves, and we expect everyone else to adapt to our language.
Yeah, I think a lot of people, too, when they hear, well, we have to talk to the other side, think, like, Gang of Eight, we need to have a compromise. No, it's not about that. It's the whole point of having these ideas and ideally, eventually, winning elections and implementing freedom for people is you have to win people over who don't currently vote your way.
Now, here's why this is going to become increasingly important. Socialism is on the rise. Socialism, I'm telling you, if we go into a recession, a deep recession during the Trump administration, I have a feeling we may be looking at a real socialist in charge of this country and in charge of the House and the Senate. We could be a socialist country that is moving away from the free market in 18 months. And when people are panicked, they're not going to listen to facts. They're going to listen to, okay, he makes me feel better. That makes me feel better. We have to talk about the heart, because people are going to be struggling much more than they are now whenever this happens. And if we don't connect with people's hearts, we're going to look like bean counters, and we'll be talking stats and everything that counts. But first you have to have the story. Then you move to facts. You have to capture the heart first. So the conservatives had a great opportunity to do this week. And we had it with Ocasio-Cortez's mother. Now, there was an article that was written, who was this by? The Guardian, I think. And it was a story that you probably heard about, and you did hear about it from me in this exact way when it first came out. And that was, did you see the story about Ocasio-Cortez's mom? Stu said, yeah, I did. It's crazy, right?
That's exactly how I said it, too.
Right.
Yeah.
And I said, yeah. I mean, look, how are these people so stupid? She struggled her whole life. Then she moved to Florida to get away from the $10,000 taxes that she was paying on her property every year.
What a hypocrite. I mean, Ocasio-Cortez wants 70%. She's moving because of $10,000. This shows they didn't know what they're talking about.
And it felt good, didn't it, to have that conversation?
And it is a point.
It is.
It's a very valid point that is worth making.
Right. But if we want to expand our circles, we need to be able to lead with the heart. Now, this is an amazing story. I went back and I read this story, and I thought, this story tells everything you need to know for our side. This is not a story for the socialists. This is a story for our side. So let me give it to you. Blanca is a woman who makes lasagna for visiting relatives and watches over her 78-year-old mother who suffers from pulmonary fibrosis and often breathes oxygen from a concentrator and a loud rescue mutt named Tammy. It's a story about mothers, but it's also a story about daughters, because Blanca always believed her daughter would be important. And regardless of your opinion on Ocasio-Cortez, and believe me, you do have an opinion on her daughter, one way or another. There's no denying the wholesomeness of this story, of this family. Now, hear me out. Her dad and I were preparing for Alexandria's birth, and we were picking names, Blanca told the reporter. And he came up with Alexandria. I thought about it for a while, and I thought, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, that's powerful. Yeah. That should be her name. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, the infamous millennial Democratic socialist who represents New York's 14th district, covering the Bronx and Queens in the House of Representatives. Her mother is Blanca Ocasio-Cortez. Blanca married Sergio Ocasio in Puerto Rico and then moved to New York, and she knew very little English, but she learned. She worked the jobs that nobody else wanted. She mopped floors at night. She drove school buses. She answered phones. She took orders. I'm going to come back to that paragraph. Now, by the way, this was written by our staff. This is not the story from The Guardian. In 1989, she gave birth to her first child, a girl, in the Bronx, New York City. 2 years later, she gave birth to a boy. Until Alexandria was five, the family lived in a one-bedroom condo in the Parkchester neighborhood of the Bronx. Theirs is the typical American struggle. Sergio worked hard until he had his own business. Then the small family pooled together their resources and took out a mortgage, and he moved into a small single-family house with a yard in nearby Yorktown Heights. Blanca said, "We had a great life there." Alexandria was social. She always had a bunch of girls over. She took over the shed in the backyard. She cleaned it up, put up curtains and photos, made it look nice. It was like a clubhouse for her and her friends. Blanca talks about her daughter in the way any good mother would, recalling her daughter. Always talkative. When I took her into pre-K interview, she didn't ever let me talk. She kept going on and on and on about knowing the alphabet and being able to count. In 2008, while Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez was a sophomore at Boston University, her father, Blanca's husband, died of lung cancer. Overnight, Blanca had to become the breadwinner. I was cleaning houses in the morning and working as a secretary at a hospital in the afternoon. It was difficult making ends meet. At one point, I had to skip the mortgage payments, and we almost lost the house. This is a story about a single mom. A single mom who raised her family after her husband died of lung cancer. As the Daily Mail notes, Sergio's death put the family into a tailspin. He didn't have any life insurance. He had 2 years of health care bills due to the money his business brought in had dried out. Blanca recalls she faced foreclosure not just once, but twice. It was scary. I had to take medicine. I was so scared. I had to stop paying for the mortgage for almost a year. I kept expecting someone to knock on the door and to kick us out at any time. There were even real estate people coming around to take photos of the house for when it was going to be auctioned. The worst is I only had $50,000 left to pay on the loan. But funny enough, it was the bank. The bank, not the welfare office, not the government, or the local church that helped her. It was the bank. I prayed that things would work out. After the children graduated from college, I figured it was time for me to move to Florida. These days, Blanca lives in Florida, a lakefront community of about 16,000 people near Orlando. She moved there just before Christmas in 2016. She had been paying $10,000 a year in real estate taxes in New York. Now she pays $600 a year. When she first got here, her world was much different. Her daughter was a bartender, hadn't filed paperwork. I love privacy and calm, Blanca said. I don't like the limelight for myself and my family, but it seems that God's played quite a joke on me with his politics stuff. Now, I don't know if the Daily Mail was sent there to do a hatchet job or what, but the story is tempting. Taxes are so severe in New York that even a mother of the wild-eyed Democratic socialist representing that area can't even afford to live in the community. But really, this is an amazing story of America. It is a tragic story of a love lost and a family shaken apart due to illness, lung cancer. It's a story of perhaps the evils of smoking. It's a hero story. A hero story of a mom who came to America not speaking any English, but didn't rely and close up in her own community. She struggled and she fought at an older age to be able to learn English and speak English and then immerse herself, because she knew if she spoke English, her family would have an easier time. And her family, who knows, her children could go on to be representatives, serve in the United States Congress in one generation. It's a sad story. It's a sad story of the collapse of community. If she felt alone and felt that there was no one in her community, that her church didn't come. She seems religious. She prayed and she prayed and she prayed. But it is, again, that hero story that in America, if you're willing to work, you can not only make it, but you can send your kids to a great college. No matter how hard you struggle, if you're willing to sacrifice and work, you can send your kids to Boston University. They can have a great education, not repeat your struggle. It is a story of the American family that struggles every day but finds joy in the struggle. It's a story of the idyllic, what we all dream of America being like. That, yes, we might have a small little house, but we've taken this old garage in the back and we've fixed it up and we've hung some curtains, and it is a place of imagination and joy for our children. It's a story about how the lie of Mr. Potter at the bank, who is just a greedy, cigar-chomping monopoly guy, who will take your home even though you only have $50,000 left to pay for it. You've struggled your whole life. Then your husband dies. A tragic story. The evil capitalist comes in, swoops in, takes the money, takes the house, and destroys the family. No, this is the Jimmy Stewart view of America, where the bank comes in and the bank works it out because you only have 50,000 and you are working. This is a great story. A great story for every conservative to tell. Because as I will show you in 1 minute, it has every piece of our argument in it. So listen to the Ocasio-Cortez story. What we said to you earlier this week when this story came out was, can you believe it? Look at this. What hypocrites, right? We're not inviting anybody else to join our group. If you don't agree with us, if you've read that story and you're like, I like this family, you're immediately turned off by the people who are like, what a bunch of hypocrites. Instead, engage with the story. Tell the story. Make the story yours. We as conservatives have to learn how to tell a story. Here is a couple that falls in love. They are in Puerto Rico. They move to New York. She knew very little English. Okay, now we have, do we love immigrants or not? Yes, we love the immigrants who want to be here. She wanted to be here. She wanted to be an American. She wanted a better life for her children. So what did she do? She learned how to speak English. She mopped floors at night. She drove school buses. She answered phones. There, nowhere in this story is her welfare story. Nowhere in here is her complaining. Nowhere. She and her husband, they come here. They live in a small one-bedroom apartment in New York. I gotta believe it wasn't very nice. But he says, we're in America now. I can build my own business. And he builds a successful business. He is an entrepreneur. He starts his own business. He doesn't wait for a guaranteed government job. He has a dream. And he comes here and he starts his own business. Now, I don't know why he had lung cancer. Maybe it was from smoking. I don't know. But he dies tragically. And yes, he has bills that pile up because he's a small businessman. Who in this audience who runs their own business cannot relate to that? You're the last one to get the money. Everybody else comes before you if you're a businessman. So he tries to keep his business going while he's struggling with lung cancer. The bills pile up. Then he dies. But before he dies, they had built a life to where they could get out of that small little apartment and get a small little house. And I mean, it is that house, if you've ever seen it, it's a miracle on 34th Street. Remember when she's like, stop the car, stop the car. Oh, I knew if I just believed. That's what Santa told me. I believe, I believe, I believe. That's the little salt box house that they bought. That's an American dream. They bought it and they paid for it. They got all the way to $50,000 away from paying that house off. They were good people that worked hard. And when he died, she continued. But it was the bank, not the welfare office, that swooped in. Here's a woman who prays, who was comforted by God, who is now taking her mother in and taking care of her family. Not sending them off to some government state institution, but bringing her into her home. But because she wants to do all those things, she needs to move to Florida. Because the government, who really in this story hasn't given her jack, except the opportunity to be an American.
The best of the Glenn Beck program.
What's the story, Pat, that you heard earlier this week about Ocasio-Cortez's mom?
She fled New York because of high taxes and went to Florida.
Did you have any idea her story was like the story I just told?
No idea whatsoever.
Right.
None.
That little tidbit came from that story, And conservatives only took that piece of it. It's a, what a hypocrite. Instead of looking at the entire story.
Which is legitimate.
It's totally legitimate.
For her, at least Alexandria.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
And I don't know anything about her mom. If her mom shares socialist values, or I don't know any of that.
I don't have any idea. Don't care if she does. Her story is the story of America.
Mm-hmm.
You're not going to Puerto Rico and having that story. You're not going to Mexico and having that story. Here's somebody who didn't even speak English.
And fought to speak English.
Yeah. Right.
I mean, that mm-hmm. we would hear, I'm sure, from Alexandria the opposite, that she shouldn't be forced to do that. But
right.
She did it to make her life, the life better for her family.
Right. And in one generation.
Her daughter's now in Congress.
No, not just in Congress. She is the leading force
yeah.
in Congress.
Apparently, yeah. which is an amazing thing.
Amazing. In one generation, God bless the USA.
Absolutely. And for the bank to show mercy to people, like, you never hear that story.
No, you never hear that.
You always hear about evil bankers and how dastardly they are as capitalists.
They had $50,000 left on this house that was not worth $50,000. It was a lot more. So they had $50,000 left.
And they could have foreclosed.
Yes.
Did you say it was a year? Of her not paying?
Of her not paying.
Wow.
And they were going to auction the house, everything else. But in the end, she talked to the bank, and the bank worked it out with her.
Amazing.
It's a great incredible.
Story. That's a great story.
And that is a story that you'll notice nowhere in that story is, and the government came down and shut down the evil bank. No, the government in that story is charging her $10,000 a year in property tax, is taking her money if she had enough and taxing her. Nowhere in here is the government swooping in to save the house. Nowhere in here. This is a story that was the typical American story. That was the American dream, that I could come here, I could build a business, I could do it my way, I could have a little, just a little plot of land, a little house where I could raise a happy family, I could send my kids to a great university, and then I could mm-hmm. retire and go someplace. She's lived the American dream.
I remember talking, this happens so often on the left. I remember talking about this years ago because, Pat, you read Barack Obama's autobiography back in the day.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember you making this point that that's a real
incredible American story. Yeah, incredible. And if he would have taken that from his story, and, you know, and people talk about, well, he said that before. He said it a couple of times. Yep. That his life is a pretty charmed one.
If he would have done that in every speech and lived it, if he actually lived what he said in his speech in 2006, if he would have actually lived that,
mm-hmm.
if that was who he was at his core, but he wasn't.
No.
He was a redistribution of wealth. He was a pay them back for all of these problems. He was vindictive in many ways. That's what the core of his being. He had some resentment, and it was time for payback. You sit in the back of the bus. Mm-hmm. Somebody who really understands the American story knows that quote that he did, you get in the back of the bus. That is the exact opposite of what allowed him to become president of the United States. While we're fighting people called Barack in the Middle East, he becomes president of the United States. And he does it with a crazy, crazy upbringing. And he becomes the president. And we were excited. And we heard, not all of us were because of his policies, but we were excited that it broke the barrier of a black man. And if he would have just let that part and be a celebration and say, look, if I can do it, anybody can do it.
Except that wasn't his attitude.
It wasn't his attitude.
He really took the opposite, which was like, you know, everyone's really racist.
Yeah.
When his own story sort of disproves it, people don't care. People don't like people who lived in other countries. They're foreign. They're different. Well, I mean, he lived in other countries, and he came back here and became president of the United States.
Yeah.
It's too rough.
With the name of one of our enemies,
right.
Barack Hussein Obama.
Yeah.
And Hussein was the name of the guy we were fighting at the time.
And Obama was one letter away from the other
Osama.
Guy we were fighting.
Yes.
Right? Like I remember hearing that when he first started running, and someone made that observation. Look, this country is no way they're going to elect a guy with those two names. And there it is.
And we did.
It happened.
And
you know,
we did.
A guy who they talk
he could
about,
have been transformative.
They talk about how life...
He could have been absolutely transformative.
He was transformative.
In the wrong way.
In the wrong way.
Just
in
the way he chose to take those things.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, it was always about how life is too hard on people who don't have enough money. And look, life is hard at times. However, he was able, and his family was able, even though they had an unstable family for a large portion of his upbringing, he was able to overcome that, get into college, achieve all these things, eventually become president.
He didn't
and instead, he takes the opposite.
He was never even on the American mainland until he was 19 years old. Yeah. He was in Hawaii and Indonesia the rest of his life. So it's a pretty amazing story. Broken family.
And I think this goes back to a central progressive belief. Like Barack Obama, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, they are both very aware that these things can happen, right? They've happened to them. But they think they are special.
Yeah, they're
most
the only ones.
Most people, they just happen to be lucky and great achievers, and they're amazing. But there's so many people who just can't do it like I can.
See, that is the exact opposite. I mean, I have led a really charmed life. I came from a broken family. My mother committed suicide. We had the same thing going on. My childhood was, are we going to lose the family business? My mother, we moved to a very, very inexpensive house, and my mom struggled to make the payments on that. I mean, I live that life.
Mm-hmm.
And now look at me. And I don't look at me and say, oh, yeah, it's
you
me.
Can't
I'm
do
special.
It.
I look at other people and like, you can do it.
Yeah.
You can do it.
Yeah.
You know, you may get to the end and go, I wish I wouldn't have done it, but you can do it.
That's true. And it really is a fundamental way of seeing the world differently.
Yeah.
You know, the progressives just, they see it as, I was lucky because I'm special, but no one else can do it, so I have to help them because I'm so wonderful. And I'm the only one who can make these decisions appropriately for these people. Where conservatives say, look, you know, because I know we've all said this, you know, you feel lucky to be able to be in a position where you're able to do a job that you love and live some comfortable life. And we've all certainly married up, all of these things that happen. And it's like, I look at that always as like, gosh, I mean, how does this even happen? Right? Like, I mean, you worked hard and you tried your best and you fell into a couple of good things and wonderful things happen because there's a lot of opportunity here and anybody can do it. Right, like that's how I think conservatives look at the world, and it's exact opposite. It's the shepherd and sheep, or the sheep and the rancher thing you've pointed out a few times.
Mm-hmm.
Where progressives just believe you have to be a rancher to control all the sheep, and conservatives believe you know people can do these things on their own. We're not sheep.
Yeah, and they think the ranchers think that anybody who says I can do it on their own is a wolf. No, they're not. They're not. People aren't sheep. There are wolves. But the person who says, I want to go do it on my own, it's just because they're not a sheep. It doesn't make them a wolf. Everybody has a chance to be a shepherd, a sheep,
right.
A rancher. You go make your own way.
And everybody who does make their own way is looked at as the wolf now. You're a bad person if you are successful. The people who are successful and who have achieved a lot, like billionaires, are now looked at as if they're immoral. Well, why? How?
For those who, I mean, I think you could make the case that some are. I mean, you look back at...
Some of everything is everything, right?
Well, there's a lot of poor people that are immoral.
There are cops that are bad. Majority, good. There are homeless people that are bad. Majority, good. It's that's people. That's people.
Mm-hmm.
But we focus on the bad and we say that's all of them. And it's not all of them. There are those bad ones. And the problem with our system as we become more and more socialist is you get special deals. Well, now the system is starting to be corrupted by the few bad, because the few bad generally like to hang out where there's lots of power. And so when you start to build this government with corrupt individuals, and I put Facebook and Google into that category. They are now spending more money than anybody else in lobbying on Capitol Hill. But you don't hear about that. You just hear about the evil Jews that do it. Google spends more money on Capitol Hill than anyone else. They are writing laws. You don't hear about that. You don't hear about that. Why? And this thing yesterday, if the Democrats don't wake up to how corrupt their party has become, and I don't mean corrupt in business or money alone, I mean corrupt with the hatred of Jews. That, make no mistake, on Monday at 5 o'clock, we're doing an expose of a couple of people in Congress and their love for the Jewish people. You know, they're from Somalia, and so they just don't know. Well, they knew how to run for Congress. They knew how to get elected. They're not dummies. How did they not know that we shouldn't say these things about Jewish people? Maybe then they're not smart enough or good enough to be in Congress. We're going to show you how much they do know and their connections. We're going back to the chalkboard on Monday. And if Americans don't see this, Democrats, good Democrats that are just your average person in the middle of the country who loves America just as much as any conservative does, if they don't see that their party has jumped the shark and is now a socialist, not Sweden, an actual end of the free market socialist party that now is a breeding ground for Muslim anti-Jewish hatred, you're going to lose your country. You're going to lose your country. And that country is worth saving for all of us.
This is the best of the Glenn Beck program. Like listening to this podcast? If you're not a subscriber, become one now on iTunes. And while you're there, do us a favor and rate the show.
Bill O'Reilly writes, right at this second, four committees in the House of Representatives are thinking up more ways to investigate President Trump. Instead of concentrating on solving vexing problems like a $22 trillion debt, a record trade deficit with China, or thousands of poor people trying to surge the southern border, these Democrats in the House are worried about things like Ivanka Trump getting security clearance from Daddy. The liberal emergency. Bill O'Reilly is here to talk a little bit more about it. Hi, Bill.
Hey, you guys. How you doing?
Good. So tell me about the liberal emergency. Yeah, I know.
Okay, so it's the national emergency that Donald Trump declared on the southern border. The far left has declared a national emergency as well, but it's not the same. Their national emergency is Donald Trump's president. Okay, that's the national emergency for many in the Democratic Party and the far left progressive movement. All right, so everything else, every other issue is subordinate to that. We got to get them out, no matter what it takes. We don't have to be honest. We don't have to be insightful. If people get hurt in the process, well, that's collateral damage because it's a national emergency. Donald Trump's got to get out, and we're going to get him. So that's where we are in this country. So if you're expecting Congress over the next 2 years to solve any problems, they're not going to. And as you pointed out, one of the they can't even get one of their members, the Democratic Party, to say, maybe calling people who support Israel greedy money people, that's not really very nice or accurate. I'm sorry I said that. Maybe that could happen. No. They're not even going to do that.
And they're not doing that because they don't want to pull apart the coalition that is trying to get Donald Trump. I mean, that was the word from Joy Behar on The View. Why are they doing this? Why do they even have to talk about this? They're separating themselves when our target is Donald Trump in 2020.
That's right. But it's even a little bit more than that, because Joy Behar doesn't have the intellect to really understand what's happening in the country. It's a little bit more than that. So you do have a genuine fissure in the Democratic Party. And you're going to see that in the upcoming campaign when Biden gets in. You're going to see it. That'll really crystallize it for everybody. So there's a genuine fissure between the far left progressives who want socialism and green whatever they want, totally remaking the country because they feel the country is bad. And the traditional Democrats, Pelosi, the party apparatchiks, who basically just want power. They don't want a big realignment of the country. They just want to run the show. So that fissure is there, and it's real. And when these young women in Congress come forth and say these insane things, the traditional Democrats go, oh, boy, this is going to make it even harder for us to obtain power. So that's what's going on in that party.
Well, Bill, doesn't there come a time like the Labour Party? The Labour Party over in England has gone so far left. They're run by a guy who has never taken the side of England on anything, stood with the USSR during the Cold War, has never, ever stood with Great Britain. Same kind of stuff we're facing here. And he is radically anti-Semitic, and in negotiations and in cahoots, I should say, with Hezbollah and Hamas, wildly anti-Semitic. And Labour Party members who are very left have now, I think seven of them have left the party and said, this is not the Labour Party. This is becoming something entirely different. Do you see that on the horizon at all? Are there any Democrats who will raise the flag and say, look, this is not the Democratic Party?
No, I really don't see it, because they might think that, but if they do that, the Twitter mob will descend on them and tear them to pieces.
So you're saying that British politicians have more courage than American politicians?
I can't generalize in that area, but I can tell you the fear among all politicians in this country and the United States is they're going to get torn apart on the social media apparatus. Yeah. So you have to understand that this permeates into everything. So no longer are you going to have Profiles and Courage. You know, John F. Kennedy wrote a book, Profiles and Courage. That's gone. Because if you stand up, if you're a Democrat in the House of Representatives, and you stand up and you point fingers at the progressive movement and say, this is out of control, not only are they besmirching a great ally in Israel, but they're linking into anybody who supports Israel that they're money hungry. So this is out of control, and I, as a Democrat, are not going to tolerate it. I'm not going to tolerate it. Well, within 24 hours, your life is going to be assaulted in a way that you cannot even imagine. You cannot even imagine. And these politicians, they don't want that. None of them do, and neither do the media people. So if you're on television, they haven't gotten a radio yet. I figure that's coming, but they haven't got radio. It's mostly television. If you're on television and you say what I just said, they're coming to sponsor boycotts. They're going to find somebody to accuse you of something. And everybody knows it now, that it's an extortion that is never before seen in the United States. And I'm telling people, I'm trying to be Paul Revere here, that you've got to understand this, the fear that has cloaked Washington, D.C., and honest media people. How much outrage have you seen about these comments about Israel and Israeli supporters?
Well, I will.
You haven't seen much outrage from the powerful people in Washington.
No.
They mealy-mouth it.
Yeah. And
it's like Pelosi. Pelosi yesterday goes, well, she didn't really mean it. Yeah, she did.
Yes, she did.
Yeah. I mean, if you trace her whole history, She absolutely meant it. Mm-hmm. But there's Pelosi, yeah, she didn't really mean it. She doesn't understand the power of the words she says. Just keep in mind what I'm saying to you. Never before in this country has there been such a threat to honest reactions.
What do you mean, honest reactions?
So if you feel that something is wrong and you stand up and that goes against the Twitter mob, that goes against the progressive movement, they're going to try to destroy you.
Well, I mean, Bill.
For you and your family. Look, if you didn't get it from Brett Kavanaugh, and I'm not saying you, Glenn Beck, and you, Stu, I'm saying you, the listeners. If you didn't get it from Brett Kavanaugh, if you didn't get what the potential for harm is now, then you'll never get it.
It is why, honestly, Bill, I have been trying so hard to try to bring conservatives together, and we have to stand together. Even if we vehemently disagree with each other, we have to stay and stand together because they're going to pick us off one by one. They're all
not conservatives. It's not just
It's anybody. Yeah.
You got to go into the precincts of the independents and precincts of fair-minded Americans. I still believe, maybe I'm naive after all these years, that most Americans are fair-minded. And that if they actually knew what was happening.
I agree.
On a two-front basis, the Twitter mob, the progressive movement, funded by tens of millions of dollars, combined with a corrupt media that basically wants to run the country. These six media companies that control 90% of the national news flow want to run the country. Jeff Bezos wants to run the United States. They have all the money they want. They can't buy any more stuff. So what's left? They want power. They're down at six companies. They want to run the country.
You know,
that's what you're seeing.
It's amazing to me that the Democrats say that they hate money in the system, and that these PACs have too much money. They're putting too much money into the system. And look at Israel and how Israel is just pumping all this money, and it's wrong, and people should know about it. The leading investment, I guess. What do you call it, Stu? The leading lobbyists, the people who are putting more money in lobbying than anybody else, are people like Google. And you don't hear anybody saying a word about Google or Amazon or anybody. That's where they're actually writing laws. Google is actually writing bills. And you don't hear anything about that.
They want the power. They have the money. They have the technology. They want the power. But here's the best example that everybody can understand. A congresswoman, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, we learn, is now being run by a multimillionaire out of Fort Worth, Texas, who pays all her bills, who financed her entire campaign, and is now being accused of funneling $850,000 out of that campaign into his private companies. You know this story, correct?
Yes. Well, I know some of it. I didn't know. I know about the funneling money. I didn't know about the person right here in my own backyard.
This is the best of the Glenn Beck program.
You know, we have a really hard time talking to people right now, talking to people who disagree with us, and our families are broken up, our friendships have been broken up. And there is a podcast this weekend. It's my podcast, and I urge you to go to wherever you get your podcasts and subscribe to the Glenn Beck podcast. You will get every Saturday a one-on-one interview. They last anywhere from an hour to 90 minutes. They're uncut. They're very candid. And a lot of times with people that I disagree with or people that I really admire. Bob Goff is one of those that I really admire. He is a guy who was an attorney and just changed his life, just totally changed his life, and has this great attitude about, hey, I'm going to be friends with everybody. I'm going to talk to everybody, and I'm not going to sell out, but I can make a difference so much easier if I just listen to people. Let me give you two cuts from this weekend's podcast. Here he is, Bob Goff, on dealing with difficult people.
I think you nailed it. I think there's a lot of people that have awesome doctrine and lousy theology. And this idea of it's easy to say to love your enemy until you have an enemy.
Yeah.
Until you have somebody that you feel disconnected. I don't feel like I have enemies, but there's certainly people that are difficult for me to be around. One of the realizations that I've had is that this idea of loving difficult people, that I'm one of them. I'm actually among the difficult people in other people's lives. And I'm trying to say, how could I interact with people? There's a, for some people in faith communities, they're familiar with a verse that talks about like being ready to make a defense for the hope that's within you. And everybody wants to like grab their swords, and but they leave out the second half. And it said to do with kindness and respect. And I think there's something beautiful about that. Like, take Switzerland. They're not mad at anybody, and I'm not mad at them, right?
Right. Like,
so if you could just walk around with a bobsled and a bar of chocolate, you can decide who you are. And everybody's trying to decide, what role am I playing in this? And I think there's a tremendous latitude in that. But I just think the role of grace, the idea of when people have just been kind to me, even when I've been wrong, that they just care more about our relationship than they do about winning an argument about something. And there's something really respectful. What has helped me with the people that like creep me out the most is to try to think of, what is it that's driving this? Like, what's the thing underneath the thing? And oftentimes it's just that they're really insecure. Me too. Like, how do you respond when you get insecure in a setting? Like, how do you deal with that? I get really funny. I get like just, I start talking really fast, and I get funnier and funnier. The more other people get mean as a rattlesnake. So how do you deal with your feeling? You get quiet and reserved. You go turtle on that, like head, legs, tail, everything inside. And so that, even in our relationships that matter the most to us, to just say, how do you deal with that? And to say, how are we like, going to react to people? You know what I wear? A mood ring. Remember those things from the 70s? Yeah. My wife's got one too. And there's something actually beautiful. What we do is we talk about how we feel more than what we want. It would be an interesting experiment. Try that for a week, to take the people that you love the most and say, don't say, I want a hamburger. Say, I'm feeling hungry. If we could get in touch with how we're feeling about something, I'm not a touchy-feely guy, but that has been so helpful in my relationships, to just talk about, I'm feeling really insecure right now.
I know this sounds like, you know, California crap, but he's so grounded and so successful. When you hear his story, he's wildly successful and grounded. And I believe he has the answers. If we are going to make it this next step, this is an important podcast. Here he is on having picky conversations. Listen to this.
I've never lost a case. And it's not because I'm an awesome lawyer. I'm an awesome picker. I only pick cases.
You're an awesome
picker.
Picker.
Yeah. I don't lose. I only take cases that nobody could lose. And so there's one of these things, to just be a little bit pickier about the conversations that you're having with people. And when you see this, say like, you know what? I wouldn't trade our friendship for the trajectory of this. And you don't have to work for NASA to know the trajectory of where this is going. Say, that wouldn't be worth it. You'll know that I'm disinterested when I start talking about sports.
Me too.
But if you know why you're doing, you will not see me very often without wearing a Boston Red Sox hat. And I'm not a Red Sox fan, never even gone to a game. But my neighbor, Carol, was a huge Red Sox fan. And we knew she was going to be in heaven by the end of the weekend, so we made a deal. I told her, Carol, I'll wear your Red Sox hat for the rest of my life and represent the Sox here on earth. Mm. But in exchange, every time Jesus walks by you, you need to mention my name. There's a verse that said, I knew you not. I'm like, Carol. But here's the deal. When I go through New York, people hiss at me. And they just be like, because they're rooting for the other team, evidently. And if they knew that I was wearing my dead neighbor's hat, they would just actually have a different angle on that thing. And I don't stop people to tell them the backstory. But I think if I could just assume in people that I don't understand, there's probably mountains of stuff going on there that I don't know about.
Bob Goff, this weekend on the Glenn Beck podcast, I urge you to listen to it and send it to your friends. Subscribe to the podcast. And this one you don't want to miss. There's a few of them that are just really remarkable people. This guy lives in a neighborhood where the whole neighborhood changed, not just because of him, but a guy who lives down the street. When he took out his trash to the curb, you know, the big trash bins, he would go from house to house and he would take everybody's trash bin and take it and put it by the curb. And then the next morning he would go and he'd put them all back. Nobody asked him. Nobody said anything. And he was like, that's what I want to serve my neighborhood. I just want to be a good neighbor. I mean, it's incredible how the bubble this guy lives in, because people are just choosing to be different.
He's the whole lineup of podcasts is really interesting. I mean, you have everything from like really amazing personal stories of people going through incredible things.
A guy who committed murder, who you just want to hug at the end.
Yeah. People who are doing amazing things. You know, a young guy who's going around the world to document World War II veterans.
Making no money,
but just doing it because he cares about it. He's in his early 20s.
He loves these veterans.
Yeah, and everything too. You know, dissecting real, like, conservative, ways of thinking, deep into these books.
With Deborah So about, you know, transgenderism and all of this stuff. I mean, it's a great podcast. Comes out every Saturday.
25 episodes of it or something like that, 26?
Yeah, subscribe now and then just start to binge on them. You will love these. A very, very different approach to what I do. The Glenn Beck Podcast, available wherever podcasts are found.
The best of the Glenn Beck program.
Will Witt is a social media influencer. He's with PragerU. He's a guy who knows his own mind and is now on a speaking tour talking about the three ways to beat the left. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me. I love being here.
So how old are you?
I'm 22. So 22. I'd be graduating as a senior in college right now if I would have stayed in.
How are you not a monster? Seriously. I mean, I watched you at CPAC. You're like Brad Pitt. You're walking around and all the girls are like, oh, Will is so great and he's so smart. I just love... I'd be a monster if I were you at 22.
Yeah, it's tough, but... it's hard sometimes, but, Dennis has been such a huge mentor to me and has taught me so much that... I mean, that's why I work for PragerU specifically, because of Dennis and his teachings to me has made me... not a monster, and he's wonderful.
You are lucky to have that as
a really
mentor.
I really am.
He is a remarkable man.
He is.
And has made such a huge difference in our country. So you're traveling now. Are you speaking on campuses?
Yeah, so I'm speaking at campuses. I'm speaking at events. Just last night I was in McAllen, Texas, speaking at the Lincoln Reagan Day Dinner down there. Mm-hmm. That was a fantastic event. I've never been down there or that close to the border.
Yeah.
It's great that there are so many Republicans there.
Yeah.
It's fantastic.
And you're talking about three ways to beat the left.
Yeah.
What are they?
So the first one is that we have to convince liberals that they're our friends. The left has duped liberals into believing there's a difference between left and liberals. You can't use those terms synonymously.
Yes.
And that liberals need to be convinced that conservatives share the same values as them. They believe in the values of America. They believe in the Constitution, freedom of speech, the Second Amendment. They don't like socialism. The only difference really between liberals and conservatives in a lot of ways is that liberals believe in bigger government. But they've been duped by the left to believe that leftists are their friends. And the leftists don't stand for any values that America was founded on.
Yeah.
And so we have to convince liberals that... they are with conservatives.
Liberals used to fight for, you know, the Bill of Rights.
Right.
And they were radicals on those things, which was good.
Mm-hmm.
A few weeks ago, I was painting this painting over here, which is...
I love it.
Thanks. It's big government in bed with big tech and big social media. And as I was painting that, I thought, I can't believe Glenn Beck is the one painting that. That should be coming from the left.
Right.
And they don't see it. They are actually promoting those things.
Right.
And the liberals who should believe this are blind to it right now.
Right.
It's crazy.
Yeah. No, they've completely changed. Right. The left is so out of touch with America and what the common people want that their main mission is to destroy America with what they want. They are for socialism. They are against freedom of speech. They want to silence you if you disagree with them. These are not the values that classical liberals have ever stood on.
They'll tell you that socialism, oh, stop using that and trying to scare people. I don't want scary socialism. We want Swedish socialism.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's what they always say. But now these people like Ocasio-Cortez and Bernie Sanders, they used to have to hide that they were socialists, right? Mm-hmm. Now it's just they say it proudly that mm-hmm. they're socialists, and they say democratic socialists, like that makes it better. Mm-hmm. It's ridiculous that we have people in Congress and in our country that proudly support these ideas.
But they've wanted to for a long time. It's when, I was at Fox, I said, because I was getting heat, because calling somebody a socialist apparently was you're a racist for doing that. And they were calling me a racist, and I said this, and in a way, I was trying to call them out. They want to tell you who they are. You know, they really want to. They're proud that they are socialist. And yeah, that's right. And you know what? There will be a few people that'll have to go. You know, they want to do it. And I said, look, this is who they are. And right now they're saying this. But there's going to come a time when the masks will come off and they'll just say, you're right. Because you know what? This free market system doesn't work. And that's right. If that's what a socialist is, then I'm proudly that. That's exactly what they're saying now.
Right. And I think it's funny that these same people like Ocasio-Cortez and Bernie Sanders, Ilhan Omar, they claim that they love America. Like at the State of the Union, when Trump mm-hmm. is chanting USA, they're chanting mm-hmm. back USA, USA. But that it doesn't make any sense because you can't say you love America, but you want to radically transform it. You know, mm-hmm. Dennis always talks about how if you have a wife, you don't love your wife if you want to radically transform her. Mm-hmm. Right. And mm-hmm. so it's the exact same thing. These people don't love America. They want to mm-hmm. radically transform it.
Yeah. I used to talk about how when Barack Obama said we want fundamental transformation. No, if you have the Mona Lisa and you respect it, you restore it.
Right.
You don't fundamentally transform it.
Right.
And the new Green Deal, I don't think they're even serious about. I mean, I'm sure there are, many are, but I think the people in Congress are not necessarily so serious about the Green New Deal being green. Because the part that disturbs me in that bill, the one that actually was being presented, not the, you know, not the Ocasio-Cortez thing, talks about the fundamental transformation of America's economic system.
Right.
That's what they care about. The whole green thing is a cover to get you to go in and fundamentally transform it and take away the free market.
Right. Well, I just tweeted about this morning. Is that there was an article from 1989 from AP News where they talked about, by 2000, entire nations were going to be destroyed by global warming, right?
Yeah, right.
And now it's 2019, and that's, of course, never happened. Ocasio-Cortez says 12 years. It's a front for votes and for creating hysteria to get you to their side. And they want to say that conservatives, Republicans are so anti-environment, and they don't care about if seals are dying, you know, these sorts of tropes. And that's so that they can win over votes, make us look bad because we don't care about something that is really a false narrative. Of course, the climate is changing, but not in any sense that these people are professing.
I grew up in the 70s, and I remember when I was about your age, the joke was, where's the ice age?
Yeah, exactly.
You know,
exactly.
And they were saying at the time, this was in Time magazine, we have to put black soot on the polar caps to melt them, to draw the heat in from the sun to melt them, because we're all going to be living under ice.
It's amazing.
I mean, it's crazy.
Approximately 75 years before Will was born, there was a movie called The Money Pit that came out with Tom Hanks and Shelley Long. And it happened to be on like HBO or something. They're not watching it. And one of the recurring jokes throughout is, you know, this is a house that's like all, you know, it's a disaster to try to fix up, and they're trying to get all these contractors to come over. And every time they ask how long whatever project it is going to take to finish, they always just say, 2 weeks. And then, you know, 3 months later, they come back. How much longer? 2 weeks. And it happens over and over and over again. That is the global warming argument. It's always 10 or 12 years from any point. From now, it's 10 or 12 years in the future. From 10 or 12 years ago, it was 10 or 12 years into the future, which is today. 30 years ago, they said 10 or 12 years ago, there was a turning point. They are never held accountable for these promises, they say, of doom that are coming our way.
And if they get their way, then it will be systematic. Then it will be, well, because of what we did,
right,
we've postponed it another 10 or 12 years.
Exactly.
But we've got to take this next step.
Yeah. Well, you have to realize this is our World War II, okay? This is our World War II, which we're fighting against.
How insulting is that?
Oh, my God. I can't believe that she would even, that would even cross someone's mind to say.
Think of the people that fought and died in World War II, and we're like, yeah, you know what? And I'm gonna tweet that we should all have a 70% tax because that's my World War II. Wow, World War II actually ended in some vaporization of people.
Exactly, getting people to shop at Whole Foods is much different than World War II.
World War II is 0.9 degrees centigrade. Really? That's your World War II? Yeah, it's not even a full Celsius degree.
It's just incredible. It's astonishing. I was in West Hollywood a little while ago.
I'm sorry for that.
Yeah, I know. Well, I live in Hollywood myself.
I'm sorry for that.
Yeah. Well, no, I like it because I like to be in places where there are people who disagree with me. That's how
I've
always
thrived. Can I say
something? Yes.
I've had a better life in Texas, but I am not as sharp as when I lived in Manhattan.
Right.
Because when you're living and you're the only person within a 3-block radius that believes what you believe, you have to always be on your toes.
Right.
And there is something to be said for that.
Right. Yeah. No, I'll tell you a story. I was out. This was a few months or about a month and a half ago, 2 months ago. And I'm out and I meet this girl and we're talking and it's a lot of fun. And then I show her my social media. She's like, okay, I got to go. Like, let's go out some other time. I show her my social media. And the first thing on there, it's a picture of me with some guns. And then she tells me, she says, oh, F off, and then leaves. And it's like, this is the tolerant left of, I've made girls cry when I tell them who I voted for all the time in L.A. So
really? It's breaking hearts.
Breaking hearts.
Breaking hearts.
That's how it
goes in L.A. Ruining their dreams.
Gosh.
Yeah. I love it.
He was so good looking, and then he turned into the devil.
Yeah, I didn't know he was Hitler reincarnated.
The Blaze Radio Network. On demand.